I am still writing a video game, so naturally, I have continued by not writing a video game.
I was going to do the old, oh, no, you're not.
It's starting to feel a bit like that, actually. But what I have written is a very complete internationalization library for Lua with Love game engine support. And you may have seen, if you've moved in localization circles, that internationalization is often shorthanded to I18N for internationalization. So I have called my project SMIT I18N, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's intended to be pronounced Smitten because it's for the Love game engine.
Oh, I get it now. Oh, sorry. You've been saying Smitten to me for like the last 2 weeks, and I've been thinking, why? Why? And that's really contrived I18N to say Smitten, and now I get Love Smitten.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Yes, I am dense. Yes, we know this. Yes.
Listeners, I can't believe that we're having this revelation
a bit
right
slow
now.
On the uptake. Yes.
The reasons why I've created this is that as I've been exploring different game genres and game ideas, there's a few things I've bumped into that are like hard problems to solve that you just want to get solved once and then just have like a good solution for. And localization was one of them, because at the end of this exercise, I do intend to make a video game that I can publish and sell for actual money. And in order to do that successfully in the current day, you actually need to make sure that your game is accessible, therefore translated for as many regions as is reasonably possible. And when I went looking in the Love community, there have been efforts to create internationalization libraries in the past, but they've sort of fallen by the wayside or they've just vanished from the internet entirely. And this is made even more complicated by the fact that because Love is a cross-platform game engine, you don't want to have to handle all of your localization in each of the different native ways that the mobile platforms handle it, that like Linux handles it and Windows and all the rest of it. And Lua tables are actually really great for handling like gobs and gobs of data. So I found some example projects that have fallen into disrepair, but looked close to what I wanted. So I have revitalized a few of them and actually smashed them together in one new all-encompassing project.
So when we're talking about the kind of internationalization you're going to need when you're writing games, I imagine there's things like if you have some text on the screen, you want it to display in the user's local language, and you want dates to be formatted according to how dates are formatted in the user's country, and numbers might be formatted differently. Are these all the sorts of things that this covers?
Yes, indeed. You're spot on there. And that last one about locale-aware number formatting and dates and currency was a key one that I couldn't find like a current solution for, and I've worked on integrating with the help of an old library that I found. But yeah, the idea here is that, you know, if you're playing the game, even in like menu systems to turn audio on and off or set your display resolution, there are some standard, you know, text that needs to be displayed on the screen in a language that the user can understand in order to just configure the game, let alone interact with characters within a game or, you know, status information and stuff like that. So yes, I've gone deep into localization and I found a project called i18n.lua, which is quite complete and very powerful, but it hasn't been updated since 2017. And that GitHub repository is sitting there with lots and lots of really interesting improvements and additions from actual game developers at actual game studios. And so I decided that I would start with that and then cherry pick all of that good work that was sitting there.
So you mentioned they're actual game developers and it got me thinking a few things that are all kind of loosely tied together. One, you mentioned last time you talked about this, that one of the targets was game jams, and game jams tend to be fast paced, as in the development cycle. And often translation is not a thing that people particularly care about when they've only got 48 hours to crank out a game, right? but some retail games, shall we say, completed games that are published, originate in game jams around the world often. And that feels like people are setting themselves up to fail if they don't. I'm not trying to sell your product for you, but like it feels like you're setting yourself up to fail if you don't do internationalization early on, because you're only going to have to do it later. And once you've already got all the code written, you've got texts everywhere, it's harder to do. So like, I can totally see why you're doing this and why aiming at game jams is a great idea. You've certainly thought about this. What my question is what do people normally do? How would you internationalize a game if you didn't have this?
So some of the bigger engines do have these facilities, for example. So if you're using Unity, or I think Godot, and I know that Unreal have these facilities built in. Love is obviously a sort of smaller framework, but I have watched countless videos from small indie game studios where they didn't think about localization up front and make it, like you said, a thing that existed from day one. And in some cases, their game has failed because it just hasn't had localization. So one of the bits of advice from the small studios that they've learned is translate your Steam page from the very beginning and state that you are going to localize the game, and then look at where the wish lists are coming from, what regions the wish lists are coming from, and then prioritize those languages in your localization efforts. And you mentioned game jams and starting quickly. So one of the other things I've done with this is it's not just a translation engine. I mean, it is. It does all sorts of clever things. It's got rich text interpolation. It handles pluralization, which to us English speakers sounds like a simple thing. But if you are a Russian speaker, plural forms, there is about six of them, depending on the volume or number of entities that are plural. Yeah, and this is common in a lot of languages. So it's handling all of the difference between one, a few, some, many, and loads. There are different plural forms. And like Mark said, the locale aware number formatting. But then I've also created complex dialogue supports. You can have branching conversations and character specific translations and context aware responses. I prototyped this thing with a shop, and having the shopkeeper say hello every time you entered the shop was a bit dull. So it has a randomization factor, and he has like 20 different greetings. So he greets you differently. So there is a finite number, but there's a little bit. And the way that he greets you then triggers like the way that that branch of that conversation goes. So the other different phrases that they use. But the key thing I've done is I found a project from Polyglot Game Dev, which is a project from about 10 years ago. And they crowdsourced a load of game specific phrases. So it is 650 or so game phrases in 53 languages.
Oh, wow.
And that is a Google sheet somewhere. They're not taking updates or new submissions. It's frozen. And they also have a CSV archived on GitHub. So I wrote a conversion utility for that and converted it to my localization format. So when you use my library, not only do you get the localization tools, but you also get 53 languages with 650 phrases that are common in games. So for creating the menus and some of the basic sort of, you know, game interactions, you've got a good starter to actually at least offer, you know, some localization support. And I've also got 36 regional number formats as well.
This is all excellent and very enjoyable. And it's a good learning experience because I didn't know anything about any of that. When are you going to write a game?
I do have a couple of game design documents that are complete, as you well know, because you're the person I bounce ideas off. But yeah, I think soon, because I've got some other bits and pieces. This infrastructure stuff, these are things that I just want there, baked in. They're just web tone for the game framework for love. So as I start to develop games, I don't have to think how to build it, how to publish it, how to distribute it, how to localize it. I can then just start focusing on how I want to build the game.
I actually used it in production for not a game recently. I used it to create a little animation that I recorded as a video and then turned into an animated GIF and posted on social media. So it actually was useful because it was very quick for me to be able to just set the resolution and draw some things on the screen. So yeah, it's been useful even for non-gaming stuff.
I have been moodling myself silly.
Have you stopped taking the pills? Is that what it is?
By the time you hear this, Moodle, which is the open source online learning platform that I work on, will be in feature freeze for its 5.0 release. And I have been contributing some fairly big things to it. So I thought maybe I could give you a bit of a rundown of what's been going on.
Is 5.0 like big anyway, as well as, you know, Mark's big things? Is it big, you know, with outside of your contributions?
I mean, there's a lot going on. The rate of change in Moodle is quite rapid at the moment, but this is actually the first in their new release scheme, basically, to try and keep things a bit clearer between major version numbers and how plugins are supported. So this is the first release of the 5.x series, and there'll be a set number of releases in that series, and then the last one will be the long-term support release.
Oh.
So the idea is that then plugins will have a release that supports the 5 series and then a release that supports the 6 series, rather than having to sort of do interim releases and not necessarily know whether you should, how far back you need to be backwards compatible. So hopefully it should make things a bit easier for plugin maintainers going forward. And also it makes it easier to deprecate old APIs as well, because it's less time that they have to hang around before they get hoiked out. But anyway, a bit of background on what I've been doing. There are two areas of Moodle where I've been focusing. So the first is Moodle's backup and restore system. So Moodle works by you create some courses and you create activities and resources in those courses, and then you enroll students and they can do, you know, they participate and they can access the resources. But because you might have multiple courses, you might want to reuse some of those things that you've created. So you can copy them and you can create backups, and you can back up to another course on the same system, or you could back up to a course on a completely separate instance of Moodle. And each plugin sort of defines its data in a way that supports Moodle's backup format. Alongside this, you've got an assessment system with a quiz module, and you have questions which you can include in your quizzes. And the questions can also be shared between courses because, for example, you might be a maths teacher and you might have 4 different maths classes that you teach throughout the week. And you might not want to be creating your questions that you're going to give to students on all 4 classes. And you might have other teachers in your department who want to reuse those same questions across their courses. So there's this mechanism in Moodle for sharing questions between courses using the question bank. Where this gets complicated, in case it wasn't complicated enough already, is what happens if you back up a quiz that uses questions which are shared with another course? And what happens if you back up the quiz and do restore it to a course which also uses those shared questions? Things can go wrong. What you often end up with in the past is you end up with duplicates of your shared questions all over the system, and it's made things a bit messy, or you end up with just breakages, things that won't back up or restore. And this has been a problem that's been going on for years, and there hasn't really been a great solution. So what I've been working on with my colleagues is a way of restructuring the question bank so that it's easier to share questions. In particular, my focus from this has been to work on avoiding question duplication. So when you restore a question into the system, it can work out, does that question already exist? Which we used to have a nice, easy way of doing, but then we made everything a lot more flexible, and that made this question a lot harder. And we've ended up with, yes, a lot of duplicates, but also a lot of breakages.
So what do? You SHA-sum the question, or does every question have a unique UUID? How have you done this?
The first one, actually.
Right.
Which is a lot more complicated than I thought it was going to be, because the way, you know, what you have in the backup isn't just what you've got in the database. And for added complexity, questions in Moodle are a type of plugin, which means people can write their own type of question with its own data structure, and you still have to be able to work out how you compare that between the two.
So given that Moodle 5 is a milestone release, and this is clearly a complex new capability, how long have you and your colleagues been working on this?
Well, the idea was first thought up for Moodle 4.
Oh, wow.
And it's, yeah, it's taken, I mean, there's been a lot of other stuff going on in this area in the meantime, but actually because, you know, we aren't the Moodle core team, we're just some people in the community who thought this would be a good idea. So a big part of this work has been discussing and convincing that this is going to be the right solution for the problem. Because we've got all of these bugs in the issue tracker where we basically just looked at them and said, well, we can't solve these until we've done this work. So part of this was convincing the people actually responsible for maintaining Moodle that making this massive change would be worthwhile and means that we can fix this. So alongside this work, there's also been a whole load of bug fixes I've been working on, because we've had power users testing all of this and doing upgrades and seeing if it works, and finding that in some cases, because of the historic problems, it doesn't work, and we need to add in some stuff to the upgrade process to fix the busted data first before we try and do this upgrade. And then among all of this is keeping an eye on the performance, because when you're running stuff like this and you've got lots of questions and lots of users and lots of joining between tables in relational databases and trying to load all of that into a web page, there's always issues with performance that you need to keep an eye on. So I've been thinking a lot about how we can optimize that and how we load data and which data we're loading. And one of the big fixes that I've been working on now is how we make it so the upgrade process doesn't take too long. If you've got a site with all of your questions in the old structure and you're moving them to the new structure, how we make it so that you don't have to have your site down for too long or parts of your site unavailable for too long while that happens. So that's been my big one the past couple of weeks.
It always feels like those kind of like big upgrades on complicated projects that the users of which can monkey with, as in a good way, like they can patch it themselves because it's open source, but also they can go and get plugins from other places and tweak those plugins. It feels like that whole upgrade process is going to be non-trivial. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do, it's a hard thing, which is why, you know, whenever I see people complaining about Ubuntu upgrades from one release to another and they're moaning about it, and then someone files a support ticket and you look at it and it's like, well, you broke it because you did something silly, but you've got to be able to cope with that, and that's hard.
Yeah, I mean, some of these bugs I've been having to go back three versions of Moodle to get to a situation where I can create the bug that's now happening for someone five versions later and then doing an upgrade, because in the current version, you can't reproduce it. It's not a problem that exists anymore, but because people have been running these sites for 10 or 20 years and upgrading and upgrading and upgrading, you know, suddenly we've got all of this cruft, which you have to take into account because it might be there.
So now you and your team have identified this big ticket item and you've cracked the back of it. What's the next big problem that you're going to sink your teeth into in Moodle 6?
Rewrite it in Rust.
We have had that come up in the forum. When are you going to move Moodle to a NoSQL database? But in all seriousness, I mean, there's always more ideas coming in, but I think our focus right now is bug fixing and making sure that everything's working. We're sort of making incremental improvements over things like, when you've got a question bank that's full of questions, how can you filter it down to the ones that you're actually interested in, adding lots more dimensions to how you can filter things, which also helps because there's a question randomization feature in the quiz which uses those same filters. So this makes it more flexible for how people build their quizzes. But I think one of the big focuses is just on tidying up and making sure that everything that we've done is really solid and maintainable for the future.
I have once again been getting to grips with Django. Back in episode 45, I talked about learning a bit of Django by fire, by diving into somebody else's project, and that project was Savannah. And quick aside, Savannah is an open source community relationship management tool. It's an application that you can either use the SaaS version, but it's also open source, so you could run it on your own estate, your own laptop, or a server you run. And it's written in Python by Michael Hall and some contributors, and it uses Django as a framework. And it's got some pointy edges, and I've been trying to smooth them out. And I've taken another look at it. I've taken a break from it for a while, and I've come back to it. I've been hacking on it recently. And part of that was because a couple of people nudged me and said, hey, when are you going to do a pull request with all these things you talked about weeks ago? I'm like, oh, gosh, yes, I should. So I found some time and I started hacking on it. And I kind of pulled together the various threads of changes that I've made. It's not done yet, but I have put together a work in progress. So it's a draft PR on GitHub against the upstream project. So I forked it and cloned it and then made some tweaks. But it's quite a challenge. I have learned a lot about Django and Python and Docker and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I found it super interesting diving into this. Like, and having a somebody else's project to pick up, a bit like you, Mark, with Moodle. Like, it existed before you turned up. And you're obviously doing a bit of archaeology. And I feel I'm doing the same kind of thing with Django because it was written by, you know, basically one person. And I don't understand fully how it all fits together because there is missing documentation. It's kind of, well, it works for me. And, you know, the SAS version works and I don't have to touch it. But I wanted it to be possible for people to contribute. And one of the blockers for contribution is it's not actually straightforward how you can run it on your local machine in a way that, you know, you're not going to mess things up with, you know, loads of Python packages and stuff. I wanted to be able to run a Docker container either on my machine or on a remote machine and be able to hack around with the code. And that's what I've got. I've got it to a point where I can, I'm just using SQLite as the database. And it works. I've still got some bits left that I need. The big ticket things that I need to do is make it a proper production instance that I can put in Docker. Because at the moment, it's just development. And if I touch the files on my hard drive, they are reflected directly in the container. They're mapped through into the container. So you can hack on the code. That's what it's for. So you can hack on the code. And it's all running in the container. It's all safely containerized. But you can manipulate the Python on your laptop and immediately see the changes in the web. And that's what I wanted. But I also want to have a production container that doesn't use SQLite and that contains all the code that needs to run and doesn't map it from your laptop so that you can build a container and deploy it on another machine and use a proper database. And that's been a bit of a challenge in the past, but I now understand it a lot better. And I feel like I'm building the building blocks of my knowledge to be able to get to that point where I can build the production container.
That actually sounds a lot like how we develop and how we run Moodle.
Oh, right. It's quite novel to me because I don't do this. Like in previous years when I containerized an application with Snap, when you build the Snap, it's actually quite convoluted to be able to edit the things that are in there. You kind of make this read-only image.
Yeah.
And you can unpack it and then poke around and mount it. And it's a bit unpleasant. Whereas this is actually quite a bit easier.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about Flutter was the hot reloading facility. So you can work on the code and it just instantly reflects what you're working on, as you've just both described. And that's probably the next not game thing I work on in love is a sort of a hot reload kind of facility, because I miss the immediacy of that. You have to sort of rebuild the game and rerun it. And that's no good if you want to test something 20 levels deep.
Right. So a couple of things that I thought I would tackle and I thought would help me learn about this a bit better was the version that's on GitHub is built on top of Python 3.9 because it's basically it works and they've left it alone. And the byproduct of that is it's old version of Django as well as old version of Python and then old versions of loads of Python modules that are used by Django and old versions of Python modules that are used by Python.
Oh my gosh.
There's loads. And so actually a significant amount of my time was individually revving modules when I'd upgraded Python from 3.9. All I did was change the Docker container from 3.9 slim to 3.12 slim. And then everything broke. And I had to go through and iterate on a whole bunch of modules. There were a few code changes I had to do because some of the APIs had changed between one module version and another. And some modules changed name completely or were repackaged as something else or they're deprecated and replaced by something else. And so there was a bit of that. There was a lot of learning going on there, which I found very useful. And I've got it working. It now works on Python 3.12, which is great, and Django 4.2, which is a lot more modern. It's not the most modern, but 4.2.19 came out this month. So, you know, that's a lot better than like 3 years ago or whatever the previous version was. But the other thing that I didn't understand fully about Django is it has this whole migrations concept. I don't know. It has a model of what the data structure should look like. And then you create automagically these migrations that when, if you make changes in the database, it does the migration of the data structure. So if you've got existing data in there, it doesn't matter to me so much because this is an empty developer database, right? But those migrations I was having problems with. Some of them would just fail. And I think they failed because they were generated on an older version of Django with an older version of like everything. And so things didn't work. There were like database schema changes that would fail. And I did a bit of research and there were a few options open to me. And one was RM all of the migrations and just recreate them. And this is like quite brutal, but you could just run like Python manage, make migrations or whatever it is. And it just goes and recreates them all. Now, that's okay for me with an empty database, but if this was deployed and someone redid that, it might screw their database up, or it might like change the structure in some way or index it incorrectly or something. So this is really only for me going forwards. I don't know how we're going to manage this for people who have existing data. I don't think it's a lot of people. So I think I might be okay. I think Michael, the maintainer of the project, is the only person who's going to be adversely affected by this because he's got the SaaS version, which has lots of data in it from lots of customers, right? And I don't know what he's going to do about that. But that's somebody else's problem. The other thing I've mentioned already, but I'm really focused on getting SQLite running first. What I really want is to get Postgres and MySQL or MariaDB working as options. And I've put all the config in. So my requirements.txt, my Docker compose and all the settings and stuff are all in there, but stubbed out. They're all commented out. And what I want to be able to do is have a production Docker container image that I can say, this is Postgres, this is MariaDB, and it work. And the problem I had is when I did this last time I looked at it was the Django migrations would fail partway through whenever you use Postgres, but they work fine on SQLite. But now I have a better understanding of how those migrations work. I wouldn't say I'm an expert. I think I might be able to solve that problem and get to my goal of having a developer workstation version of Savannah and a production deployable version.
Every time you say Docker or Docker compose, I still do a double take.
Who is this man? Yes, I'm kind of got into it. I'm still not a Docker fan or a Docker expert in any way, but it has been interesting to learn all this stuff because like we use it at work a lot and we're always scanning containers with Sift and Gripe and stuff like that. And that's the other thing. Like if I built a container with Savannah in it and pointed our vulnerability tool at it, it would find lots of very old Python libraries and loads of old stuff that, you know, it would be a bit crusty. And I don't really want to put my name on that, which is why I wanted to upgrade from Python 3.9 to at least something in this century version of Python. And it's going pretty well. I'm enjoying it.
That is rule 101 of ethical security, is don't put anything out on the internet and in the wild that you wouldn't be happy with running yourself. So good on you.
Yeah, well, we'll see. So I'll put a link to the PR, the draft PR in the show notes. It's a mess and it's not finished and I've got loads of work in progress stuff. And the other thing is the title of the PR is like add Docker config, but there's like a migration to Python 3.12 in there and there's a migration to Django 4.2. I don't know how to pick those apart because they're like, I couldn't, in all honesty, create a Docker container that is built on 3.9 and is horrible. I would rather just do the whole lot. Now it may be that PR never lands and it's just forever, you know, sat in draft. I don't know. I don't know what the right thing to do there. I know I should have done atomic changes, but that was very hard because I couldn't even get like to get 3.12 working. I had to do loads of changes and redo all of the migrations. There's so much changed because nothing has changed in that code base really for a couple of years. So. Yeah, I think at the next open source conference when I bump into Michael, I'm going to have to ply him with some beer and say, yeah, just merge it. It'll be fine. But if anyone else has any good stories of how you shrink down something like that and break it down after the event, I'd love to hear it.
I have in the past done this where I've committed a load of stuff and thought, oh no, this does four different things, and then gone through with Git amend and worked out which bits belong in which commit and managed to break it out so each thing is actually a sensible atomic thing I can describe. Not an easy task.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, the old question about, you know, how the person asking for directions, and the answer is, well, I wouldn't start from here.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't start from having a giant PR. I, you know, do I start again now before I commit this? I mean, I've got a lot of learned knowledge, but the result is I'm still going to have to do a lot of stuff to get to Python 3.12 and do a lot to get, you know, the container built and so on. I don't know.
I have a suggestion for you, which you might not like the sound of.
Mm-hmm.
You go back and do it again, and you do one PR which goes from Python 3.9 to 3.10, and then you do another PR which is 3.10 to 3.11, and then 3.11 to 3.12.
I don't think that would help. I think even if I just did one from 3.9 to 3.12, and that was the first PR, yeah, I could get away with that. I could probably do that, you know, in a new clean slate, and forget about Docker and just try and get it working in a Python virtual environment, bumping Python. I could do that. That would probably be a good starting point. Just get all the packages up to date. But I would still almost certainly have to redo all the Django migrations. And I think that's going to be the thing that's going to hurt.
Oh, I see. Regardless. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a fun journey and I'm really enjoying it because I'm learning lots about lots and it's all very interesting. So yeah, keep tuned and look at the laugh at my enormous PR on, in which will be linked in the show.